Act 5 opens with what's called the comic relief, the grave diggers, the grave diggers. As I've said so often when I've lectured on various comedies here, the whole purpose of comedy, one of the main purposes of comedy, is to bring everything down to earth. This particular comic relief really does that. In fact, it brings us into the earth, down below the earth. It is, without a doubt, the most famous scene in the play. If you look at the cover of most Hamlet editions, you'll see one of two things: Hamlet with the ghost, or Hamlet staring at the skull. And those are the defining moments of the play. It's not accidental that artists, often in their intuitive wisdom, choose one of those two images for this play, because that really gets to the core of the play. Shakespeare had the comic actors in his company. They were popular, so he always gives them something to do. They get an extended scene here, and Act 5, Scene 1 is quite long. It's the longest of all the comic relief in any of the tragedies. But what we'll find is he is continuing the basic themes of the play. Just as a composer for an orchestra will turn a theme upside down or pass it to another instrument, and therefore give an entirely different feel to it. That is, a theme that is played with great sweetness and elegance on a violin is not going to sound the same if he passes it to the bassoon. You're suddenly going to get a very different feel for that theme. Certain themes are going to take on a very different aspect at the opening of the fifth act when the gravediggers start talking about them, and that's what's going to happen here. Before I begin, let me say that this touches on realism. They're speaking prose. They're speaking comic prose. It's still well structured by Shakespeare, but the incident is absolutely correct and remains so. It was only a little over a week and a half ago I attended the funeral of my uncle, a Protestant funeral, very sad. We went off to the burial site, which was some miles outside of town, and little cemetery out in the open air in farm country. And I felt helpless in the face of that Protestant service, which is totally inadequate to the grief, I won't go into that. I have other things to do. But let me just say that I stayed at the cemetery. I felt the need to do something. So I was going to at least pray the rosary at the gravesite of my uncle. And so everyone else finally left, and I was back in the shadows under the bushes. It was a warm day. And the gravediggers showed up, who were actually going to put the casket down into the ground. And it was Hamlet, Act 5, Scene 1. They had a job to do. This is what they do. They're not sentimental about death. They were talking and cracking jokes and going about their business and singing little songs. I couldn't believe it. I was watching the gravediggers from Hamlet. 400 years may have passed, but gravediggers are still exactly the same. So I can assure you, this is realistic. Absolutely realistic. Act 5 begins. We're in the churchyard. The second time we are outside of the castle. And they're called the clowns simply because that's who would have played the roles, okay? It's to let us know that this is a comic moment. And they're digging the grave. They've got the spades, and they're talking about the status of Ophelia now that she is dead. And the question to be debated, is she to be buried in Christian burial that willfully seeks her own salvation? This is a typical Shakespeare comic character who blunders in speech. The thing that most Shakespeare comic characters have in common is they cannot use the language properly. This is a perfect example of the blunder, of course. He means to say damnation. He says salvation, but it's Shakespeare working, and in a curious way, again, giving us more information than the character knows he is delivering. The second, I tell you, she is. She is to be buried in Christian burial. Therefore, make her grave straight. The crowner, the coroner, hath sat on her and finds a Christian burial. The debate here is whether or not Ophelia committed suicide. If she committed suicide, the church would forbid her being given a Christian burial. The coroner looked at it and decided, no, it was accidental. It was an accident. She did not commit suicide. She's granted Christian burial. How can that be, the first clown says, unless she drowned herself in her own defense? What's missing, it's wonderful. What's missing here is their knowledge that she was insane at the time, that she had lost her reason. How can that be unless she drowned herself in her own defense? Why, 'tis found so, it must be, say, offendendo. Okay. He's trying to say in self-defense, he says in self-offense. It cannot be else, for here lies the point. If I drown myself wittingly, it argues an act. And an act hath three branches. It is to act, to do, and to perform. Argo, she drowned herself wittingly. Please notice, the comic relief is talking about action here in this play that has been obsessed all the way through with the nature of action and belief. And even in the comic moment, what we're talking about is the nature of an individual action and how it connects to faith. How did she die? What was the manner of her death? And should she be given a Christian burial depending on how that action was performed? This is totally consistent with what we've been following all the way through the play, but we are now getting it in a comic vein. He is now treating the same ideas with comedy. Nay, but hear you, good Mendelver, give me leave. We have an argument that we have a theological argument and a philosophical argument that is erupted between the two. Nay, give me leave. Here lies the water good. Here stands the man good. If the man goes to this water and drown himself, it is will he nilly, he goes. Mark you that. But if the water come to him and drown him, he drowns not himself, Argo. He that is not guilty of his own death shortens not his own life. There is a kind of crackpot logic there, if you can follow it, but don't spend too much time trying to sort it through. But the notion indeed is this. Was death sought out? Was death sought out, or was it an accident? That's the basic argument. And it is a hugely important argument that is also going to apply during the course of this act to our hero. Did he seek out death, or did death come to him? And we're having the last act of this play introduced with that question. Then the second clown comes up, of course, with the standard social argument. Well, you have the truth on it. If this had not been a gentlewoman, she should not have been buried out of Christian burial. Okay, it's because of her rank, but of course gets it wrong. She should have been buried out of Christian burial. That is correct. If it hadn't been for her rank, she never would have been buried as a Christian. Why, there thou sayest. And the more pity the great folk should have countenance in this world to drown or hang themselves more than they're even. Why should they have this? Why should they have this special benefit of being allowed to drown and hang themselves? This is funny stuff. We must not take this too seriously. It's wonderfully funny stuff. And then a whole series of delightful jokes. There are no ancient gentlemen. The oldest gentlemen are gardeners, ditchers, and grave makers because they hold up Adam's profession. Was he a gentleman? He was the first that ever bore arms. It's just wonderful. These aren't bad jokes, actually. Why, he had none, said the second clown. What art thou, a heathen? How dost thou understand the scripture? The scripture says Adam digged. Could he dig without arms? I'll put another question to thee. If thou answerest me not to the purpose, confess thyself. Go to. What is he that builds stronger than either the mason, the shipwright, or the carpenter? The gallows maker, for that frame outlives 1,000 tenants. Oh, I like that went well. Good. Oh, you got it. Oh, you're clever. It's a wonderful little scene. But as I said, it all is of a piece. It is all of a piece. Now, the gravedigger starts singing a song as he digs. And what's he singing? In youth when I did love, methought it was very sweet. To contract all the time for my behold, when we thought there was a nothing amid. He's singing about love. And once again, we have the connection here at the end of the play between love and death. Hamlet is shocked. He finds something inappropriate in this. Has this fellow no feeling of his business that he sings at grave-making? Horatio understands. Custom hath made it in him a property of easiness. Well, it's just he's so used to doing it. Nothing out of the ordinary. And the first skull comes up out of the grave. Notice Hamlet's response. That skull had a tongue in it and could sing once. How the knave jowls it to the ground as if it were Cain's jawbone that did the first murder. It might be the pate of a politician, which this ass now o'er offices. One that would circumvent God, might it not? Okay. We are speculating on the identity of the skull. And the point is going to run throughout the entire scene, death is the great leveler. By looking at the skull, we can no longer identify the man. So that Hamlet is going to speculate at length on who might have inhabited, whose brains and tongue might have inhabited this skull at one time. It could be a politician or a courtier, which could say, good morrow, sweet lord. How dost thou, sweet lord? This might be my lord such a one that praised my lord such a one's horse when he meant to beg it. Might it not? Okay. Aye, my lord. Why, and so, and now my lady worms, chapless and knocked about the mazard. We don't even, there is real gender equality here. Okay. This is ultimate gender equality. If you get into gender equality big time, here's where you can find it perfectly. Can't tell from the skull if it was a man or a woman. It might be, as he calls it, my lady worms, chapless. It's the jaw's fallen off, okay? Here's fine revolution, and we have the trick to see it. This is real revolution. This is classless. There's no class here. There's no gender here. It's okay. Did these bones cost no more the breeding but to play at loggots with them? Was the entire lived life of this human being meant for no more than to come down to this, that the grave diggers can toss them around as if they're playing games with them? Mine ache to think on it. Hamlet's bones ache to think about this vision of death. But please notice, there is a kind of consistency here. He has been obsessed with death from the beginning of the play, and it is appropriate that at the end of the play, he find himself in a graveyard. We now have the external setting fitting what has been the mental obsession all along, and he is staring at dead objects. And again, it is appropriate, and another skull gets tossed out. There's another. Why may not that be the skull of a lawyer? Okay? More possibilities. But please notice, all from the court. Politicians, courtiers, lawyers. This fellow might be in his time a great buyer of land. With his statute, his recognizes his fines. We're running through a whole series of possibilities, all coming down to death. All coming down to death. All worldly activity. And we're getting a series of actions here, okay? The politician, the courtier, the lawyer, the buyer of land, with all the legal proceedings, all that paperwork, and what does it come down to? The skull. His double vouchers, his recoveries, okay? And whoever inherited that land at the end of that speech will eventually come to this as well. Not a jot more, okay? The first clown isn't troubled. He continues singing all the way through this. And he begins talking to the gravedigger, who's one of the few characters in the play that gets the better of Hamlet, at least in terms of wit, okay? What man dost thou dig it for? For no man, sir. What woman, then? For none neither. Who is to be buried in it? One that was a woman, sir, but rest her soul, she's dead. Such fine distinctions are obliterated. The grave maker comically making the same point that Hamlet was just making. But please notice, Hamlet is still trying to preserve those fine distinctions. Is it a man? Is it a woman? The grave maker says, well, no, was a woman. And Hamlet says, how absolute the knave is. We must speak by the card or equivocation will undo us. And again, he stares at the skull. By the way, a sidelight here, I'm not going to look at it closely. We find out Hamlet's age at this point. The gravedigger says he began digging graves the day young Hamlet was born. Okay? And then later he says he's been digging graves there for 30 years, which means Hamlet is 30 at this point. We think of him as much younger at the beginning of the play. Shakespeare will often play with time in the course of his plays. They will not run strictly by the clock. And the young man, the college student, if you will, of Act 1 by Act 5, has the weight of age beginning to come on his shoulders. He's 30. He's 30 years old. We've not gone through that period of time in the action of the play. In a curious way, we have in the aging of Hamlet's thoughts. He's no longer a young man here. The weight, the heaviness of maturity is beginning to come upon him, all right? Then the question, how long will a man lie in the earth ere he rot? In faith, if he be not rotten before he die, as we have many pocky corpses nowadays that will scarce hold the laying in, I will last you some 8 year or 9 year. He's not rotten when we put him in the ground. Oh, he'll last 8 or 9 years. A tanner will last you 9 years. Why, he more than another. Why, sir, his hide is so tanned with his trade that he will keep out water a great while, and your water is a sore decayer of your horse and dead body. It's the water that destroys the flesh. Curiously, a hint of Ophelia again. Who are we digging the grave for? One who was destroyed by water. It's a curious echo of that death. Here's the skull now. This skull has lain in the earth 23 years. Whose was it? A horse and mad fellows it was. Whose do you think it was? Nay, I know not. A pestilence on him for a mad rogue. It poured a flagon of Rhenish on my head once. By the way, please notice, we're told, in a way, he was of the court. He was around in the drinking parties, cracking jokes. This same skull, sir, was Yorick's skull, the king's jester. This, even that. Here we come, famous speech, okay? As with all the famous speeches in Shakespeare, they're famous for a reason. They sum up the core of the play. We get to the hard questions of any play in those famous speeches. Boom, here we are. Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio. We suddenly have a skull we can identify. Not by the physical fact of the skull, but because there's someone around who knows whose skull it was. Why? Because this man buried him here. Knows which grave it is. That's the only way it can be identified. It cannot be, the skull cannot be identified any other way. A fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy. He hath borne me on his back 1,000 times. Happy memories. And now, how abhorred in my imagination it is. My gorge rises at it. The miserable fact of the skull, the fact of physical death, threatens to destroy those happy memories. Okay? Hamlet remembers the good times, being a young boy, carried on the back of Yorick, the fun times, and now how abhorred in my imagination it is. My gorge rises at it. That man who showed such kindness to me, who played with me, this is what he's come to. Here hung those lips that I have kissed I know not how oft. They're not there now. Only the bone. But worse than the loss of the flesh, where be your jibes now, your gambols, your songs, your flashes of merriment that were wont to set the table on a roar? The wit. Everything that defined the intellect of the man is gone. The ability to make everyone laugh, to sing a song, to be the life of the party, which also made, of course, the child love the jester. It's not unusual that the child will love that one who can make jokes and have a good time, which makes a special bond, clearly, between the young child, Hamlet's memory, and now here is what seems to be all that's left of it. Not one now to mock your own grinning. You can't even make a joke about your own state now, this ghastly smile on your skull. Quite chapfallen, okay? The flesh around your mouth has all fallen off. Now get you to my lady's chamber and tell her, let her paint an inch thick to this favor she must come. Make her laugh at that. We're back to the theme of women covering their faces with makeup. God hath given you one face and you make for yourself another, he said to Ophelia. Claudius's vision of the harlot putting paint on her face to look beautiful and covering up the rot that was underneath. Now we get it again. But we still get that sense of anger. Who is my lady? His mother, Ophelia. His anger at women still there. Why? Because they can't be trusted. And tell her, let her put an inch of makeup on her face. This is how she's going to end up. Make her laugh at that. You're a jester. Turn that one into a joke. See if you can make her laugh at that. Prithee, Horatio, tell me one thing. What's that, my lord? Dost thou think Alexander looked to this fashion in the earth, e'en so, and smelt so? Pah! This thing stinks, and he has to throw it down. The smell finally overcomes him. This is realism. E'en so, my lord. To what base uses we may return, Horatio? Why may not imagination trace the noble dust of Alexander till he find it stopping a bunghole? Notice Horatio's response, were to consider too curiously to consider so. Ah, don't think about it. Don't go there. Don't go there. No faith, not a jot, but to follow him thither with modesty enough and likelihood to lead it, as thus. Alexander died. Alexander was buried. Alexander returneth into dust. The dust is of earth. Of earth we make loam. And why of that loam, whereto he was converted, might they not stop a beer barrel? Impeccable logic. You can't argue it. Why Alexander? How did we get from Yorick to Alexander? We've gone from the least in the court of Elsinore to Alexander. What have we gone from? We've gone from wit and sharp thinking in Yorick to the man who conquered the known world, the man of action, the ultimate man of action, the one who acted more than any other figure in human history. And the question remains the same. Why bother to be witty and intelligent and sing songs? Why bother to conquer the known world? Where does it get you? Death, death. What do you leave behind? A skull. That movement that is Hamlet's thinking at the beginning of the play now touches bottom. This is 20th century Samuel Beckett nihilism. There is nothing. Why bother doing anything? Because it all comes to death. It doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter what you do, as long as there is death, it negates life. And he deliberately goes to Alexander in terms of thinking of the greatness of the man of action, whose actions don't matter, they could not keep him from death. And not only that, because of the physicality, ultimate indignity. not even a matter of showing respect to the body. Doesn't matter if he was put in a tomb somewhere. The body still just turned into earth, of earth we make loam, stopping a beer barrel. Down to basics. Okay? Now, remember, man, that thou art dust, and dust to dust thou shalt return. That part of it's accurate. But the faith tells us there's something that triumphs above that. That is not the last word. For Hamlet, it seems here to be the last word. And it becomes a kind of consolation for him for never having taken action. What did the action matter? Why bother? This is what it comes for. And then we get the point made again. Imperious Caesar, dead and turned to clay, might stop a hole to keep the wind away. Oh, that earth which kept the world in awe should patch a wall to expel the winter's flaw. And his thoughts turned to Caesar. Yorick, Alexander, Caesar. What did it matter? Caesar was simply earth that managed to keep the world in awe for a while, but over time, also becoming just earth, might patch a hole in the wall. Caesar is rendered down to nothing. But please notice what is clearly implicit there, and that is a little conversation with Polonius from the second act. Didn't you act once? Yes, I played Caesar, says Polonius. Brutus killed me in the Capitol. Hamlet said, a brute act to kill so capital a calf. So that as he says, well, Caesar died and became nothing, it is in a curious way at least hinting at an excusal of the action he has taken against Polonius. Why does it matter? Caesar would have died anyway. Caesar just becomes dirt. The dirt might patch a wall. It doesn't matter. There's nothing. Please notice as well, this whole scene is rendered in prose. And for most of Acts 4 and 5, Hamlet has been speaking prose. There is a coming down in terms of language. He's been very witty, as always. But the poetry is gone until this little jingle here, this little song he sings. And let me sum up. What is it he's saying in the graveyard? Action doesn't matter. Thought doesn't matter. This character who thought and thought and thought. Wit doesn't matter. This wittiest of almost all of Shakespeare's characters. None of it matters. Why? Because you're going to die. You're just earth. You're going to return to the earth. Death is the great leveler. It flattens everything. And because of it, life has no meaning. Hamlet has struck bottom. You can't go lower than this. The universe is empty. It's all accident. Here we are. Death wins. We're bones. We go back to earth. Nothing matters. This is one of those moments. It's the equivalent of what I was just speaking about in As You Like It. Jaques says, old age finds you without sense, without teeth, with nothing. In comes old Adam. Hamlet in the graveyard says, death is the leveler. You come down to nothing. Death renders everything meaningless. There's no point. There's no purpose. Why bother? Notice the next line. But soft. But soft a while. Here comes the king, the queen, the courtiers. Having just said, death makes everything meaningless, in comes the funeral cortege. Who is this they follow? And with such maimed rites, this doth betoken the course they follow did with desperate hand fordo its own life. 'Twas of some estate. Couch we a while and mark. And his first point is accurate. He cannot tell. He cannot tell who's dead. He cannot tell because of the death, the corpse being covered at this point. He doesn't know who's dead. Who's dead? Who was it? But he is trying to notice, figure out who it was. Curiosity. It still matters to him that much. Couch we a while and mark. What ceremony else? That is Laertes, a very noble youth. Mark. How can there be nobility if life is meaningless? And yet he's back to his better instincts from the moment the corpse of Ophelia comes on the stage. And he's drawing a distinction between one man and another, distinctions that he just said didn't matter, but the very presence of Ophelia's corpse overturns his nihilism. That is Laertes, a very noble youth. Mark, what ceremony else? I won't go through the priest's response, but please notice the priest is in Elsinore. He's being political. He is very nervous. But he will not come down to an ultimate decision. That is, saying the coroner apparently said she was to be buried in Christian burial. There is enough question still of suicide that she could be forbidden Christian burial, so the priest is giving sort of half a job, maimed rites. We'll do a little bit, but we won't do everything. Okay? We have the sense of him looking over both shoulders. Everybody's nervous in Elsinore, even the priests. So we try to hedge our way out of it. Laertes, must there no more be done? No more be done. We should profane the service of the dead to sing a requiem and such rest to her as to peace parted souls. I would simply say, the suggestion seems to be that Ophelia's death was accidental. I think in terms of what happens in the play, we get the sense Ophelia's death was accidental, or whatever happened, she is not in her right mind. That's very clear. So it could, whatever she did was not done with the full consent of the will. But we even have here the sense of the corruption in Elsinore that she may not get a burial she deserves. Laertes has a moment, lay her in the earth, and from her fair and unpolluted flesh may violets spring. May she become the source of flowers. You remember the comment she makes, there's a daisy for you. I cannot give you violets. They all withered when my father died. Heartbreaking. The image comes back. And from her fair and unpolluted flesh may violets spring. I tell thee, churlish priest, a ministering angel shall my sister be when thou liest howling. And we get the response. And please notice, it's in poetry and it's a shared line. It's what we call the shared line. When thou liest howling, what the fair Ophelia? Laertes and Hamlet share a line. And he recognizes the corpse. And it is the fair Ophelia. You remember Lady Worm that he was just joking about. None of it mattered. None of it mattered. And women being women didn't matter. The makeup would come off. They're all just skulls. Nope. Just as we have the noble Laertes, now we have the fair Ophelia. There is recovery of a small sort, but we have the stirrings of something decent in the hero's soul, finally. The queen scattering flowers. This very action can kill you if you consider it. The last time we saw Ophelia, she was handing out flowers. Now here is Gertrude, and it is almost a moment of healing for Gertrude. As she puts flowers on the corpse. Sweets to the sweet farewell, I hope thou shouldst have been my Hamlet's wife. I thought thy bride bet to have decked, sweet maid, and not have strewed thy grave. Laertes loses it and leaps into the grave to hold Ophelia one more time, and Hamlet re-enters the drama. He's been withdrawn. He's been away from the action. And at this moment, he chooses to re-enter the drama. And please notice the speech. What is he whose grief bears such an emphasis, whose phrase of sorrow conjures the wandering stars and makes them stand like wonder-wounded hearers? Okay? Who are you to grieve for this woman? Who are you to grieve so vocally and loudly? This is I, Hamlet the Dane. Throughout the rest of the play, when he has used the name Hamlet, it's been in reference to his father. He almost never speaks of himself by name. And now, in rejoining the action of the play, identifying himself as an equal mourner with Laertes, he now identifies himself by name, Hamlet, and positions himself as a member of this court, Hamlet the Dane. The response, Laertes leaping at him, "The devil take thy soul!" Laertes is speaking consistently with his behavior in Act 4. Okay? That was the language of Act 4. Notice Hamlet's response, "Thou prayest not well." And again we have a moment of sense from Hamlet. It is truthful. And then notice, "I prithee take thy fingers from my throat." He does not respond in kind. I mean, there is the battle there is that battle back and forth. But Laertes is clearly the stronger of the combatants. "For though I am not splenetive and rash, yet have I in me something dangerous." This is self-evaluation and honest. He says, "Look, I'm normally not rash and dangerous, but there is something in me, and I can be, so look out." And that is an absolute accurate representation of what we've seen in him in the play up to this point. And that one moment when he was splenetive and rash and dangerous was the moment when he killed Polonius. And he's saying, "Look, I don't usually do stuff, but there's something in me. There is something in me. Look out. Which let thy wisdom fear. Beware of me. I'm capable of something. Hold off thy hand." It is reasoned and temperate. It includes an honest self-judgment and an honest criticism of Laertes. And this is in the midst of a fight. We have finally the moment of tragic knowledge. It is taking place over the corpse of Ophelia. Her death and the recognition of her death has brought alive something good in the hero again. I said she was the barometer. She continues to be. And part of it is very clear. Watch what happens now. "Pluck them asunder. Hamlet, Hamlet, gentlemen, good my lord, be quiet. While I will fight with him upon this theme until my eyelids will no longer wag." Gertrude says, "Oh my son, what theme?" And he says, "I loved Ophelia." If only he'd told her that while she was alive. The politics of the court made it impossible, but at least now he can say it. And please notice, if love and death have haunted the end of this play, we have the sense that one is stronger. And this seems genuine. This figure who was saying there is nothing, death wins out over everything, is now admitting to love. "I loved Ophelia. 40,000 brothers could not with all their quantity of love make up my sum. What wilt thou do for her? Zoon, show me what thou do. Would weep, would fight, would fast, would tear thyself, would drink a bisel, eat a crocodile, I'll do it. Dost thou come here to whine, to outface me with leaping in her grave? Be buried quick with her, and so will I. I'll go down into the grave alive with her. That's how much I loved her. I will fight with you over the question of how much we loved her." He's found something he will fight about. It's his love for Ophelia. There is something that does have meaning, and it's what he feels, what he has felt all along for this young woman. "And if thou prate of mountains, let them throw millions of acres on us till our ground, singeing his pate against the burning zone, make Ossa like a wart. Nay, a mouth, I'll rant as well as thou. I'll rant on about how much I loved her, how great that love was." And he's speaking poetry again, and it's grand and it's heroic. "This is mere madness," says the queen, okay? And then he says, "Hear you, sir, what is the reason that you use me thus? I loved you ever." And he admits to a love for Laertes as well, but it is no matter. "Let Hercules himself do what he may. The cat will mew and dog will have his day." Who's he connecting with Hercules? Himself. And who's the dog that will have his day? Laertes at the present time. And we're back to that first act soliloquy. But no more like my father than I to Hercules. And now the Hercules image reappears, and we've got something heroic in this young man again. In this aging young man, okay? And he simply leaves the scene rather than continue the fight. Okay, I'm gone, and he vanishes. Please notice he is gone for the measure of about six lines. And he is back again instantly. Instantly. He comes back in, and we're in the middle of the conversation with Horatio. And he tells the story of the sea voyage that we haven't heard yet. And at the end of his first speech, he says quite openly, and that should learn us. Excuse me. Back it up. Let us know our indiscretion sometimes serves us well when our deep plots do pall. And that should learn us. There's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough-hew them how we will. We may make a mess of our lives, but there is a divinity there that is still shaping and guiding us. This is new talk again. There is once again a sense of the divine that is governing events. It is a small, but nevertheless real, recognition of something beyond. And we have again a movement forward. Now, he gives the story of discovering that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern were out to kill him. That the king had sent letters with them, they were to deliver them, the letters were to see to it that he was put to death, and he says he exchanged the letters. And this is on the sea voyage, and this is, I would say, the old Hamlet, okay? The letters he put, that without debatement further, more or less, that is the king of England, should put the bearers to sudden death. Not shriving time allowed. Don't even allow them to go to confession. Put them to death. Whoa! Horrific. He seals it because he has his father's ring, and he seals the statement with his father's ring. Okay? The first time that, in a way, he steps into his father's shoes. It is a grisly thing he does. Horatio simply says, so Guildenstern and Rosencrantz go to it. And then he makes a defense and says, why, man, they did make love to this employment. They openly and freely chose to work for a great evil. In fact, they loved it. They are not near my conscience. They chose their own end. Their defeat, by does their own insinuation grow? 'Tis dangerous when the baser nature comes between the pass and fell insensate points of mighty opposites. They got caught in a huge battle between two mighty opponents. Who are they? Claudius and Hamlet. He's now speaking of himself as a worthy opposition to Claudius. What's the vision? I am going to clean up the court. I'm going to get rid of this guy. But notice the unbelievable, he's not aware of it, what do we get? Rosencrantz and Guildenstern got caught between the points of the two swords going at each other, and they were pass and fell insensate points. A little hint of that poisoned sword that's going to bring him down. Horatio, why, what a king is this? Does it not think thee, stand me now upon? Look, am I not obligated? And now we get a list of why he has an obligation to root this evil out of Denmark. One, he hath killed my king, not father. We have the young prince of Denmark who says, he killed the king of Denmark. He was my king. He hath killed my king. There is a recognition here of some distance between father and son. Something we may have suspected. The overpraise of the father in the beginning, the trouble in learning some truths about the father later. We don't get father, we now have what Hamlet can recognize as real, my king. He hath killed my king and whored my mother. And now he simply states it as a fact. He's dealing with a realistic fact. Popped in between the election and my hopes. It's the first time he said this. I should have come back and been put on the throne. He grabbed the occasion of the throne being empty before I got back and saw to it that he got to be king. And that is the third reason he gives. Killed my king, whored my mother, and took my rightful place. I should be king of Denmark. Thrown out his angle for my proper life. Then he tried to kill me. And with such cousinage. And he didn't try to kill me directly. He was underhanded and sneaky about it. Is it not perfect conscience to quit him with this arm? And is it not to be damned to let this canker of our nature come in further evil? The ghost is gone. The revenge called for by the ghost is gone, and we get a list of reasons why Hamlet says, I now must do something about this man. But please notice, it is phrased as two questions. Am I not right now to kill him? Question mark. And would it not be damnation for me if I let this go on? If I let this evil continue? Second question. They are honest, debatable questions. Those questions can be argued. Horatio doesn't answer the questions. And it is here again that the problem of Hamlet rises up, but it is no longer, I would say, that he is an agent of the ghost seeking revenge. He has now, with a kind of maturity and some knowledge, stated exactly what the problems are and raises those questions. And they hang there till the end of the play, but he's decided, I've got to get rid of this guy. I must do it. I think that's right. Those are debatable questions. In comes Osric. I just have a moment here. What characterizes Osric is he is a perfect lackey of the court. He is all externals. He is all manners. We know he keeps making flourishes with his hat. It's commented on. He speaks euphuistically, which was a formal literary style that Shakespeare would always parody, that came from a writer of the day named John Lilly in a play called Euphues. Balanced sentences, flowery expression, and we almost get an image of what Hamlet could have turned into. All words, all externals, and Hamlet himself is outraged by this character. Tweaks him, plays with him, but this becomes the agent by which he then goes in to begin the final duel with Laertes. But again, the court is totally corrupt. Hamlet thinks he is going into a fencing match. Laertes knows that Hamlet is going into a death match. The king knows that he's going to get rid of Hamlet during the course of this, if not by the foil, then by the poisoned cup. The audience sees Hamlet going into a contest that is fixed against him. The corruption is so great, and personally, I think that sense of the evil spreading through Denmark is very clear. Personally, I feel a measure of sympathy in Hamlet saying, I've got to root this out or it's just going to spread. And then we see it spread. Hamlet himself is caught in this ever-increasing net. We begin the fencing match, but before it begins, everyone comes in, come Hamlet, come, take this hand from me. The king puts Laertes' hand into Hamlet's hand, and we get Hamlet saying, give me your pardon, sir, I've done you wrong. It's tragic knowledge again. There is a measure of greatness reappearing in this character. He's about to fight him. It's a duel. He thinks it's a game, but his first words to Laertes are, I have done you wrong, but pardon it, as you are a gentleman. And it is a double wrong. He ranted at Laertes at the gravesite, and he killed Laertes' father. It is a double wrong. This presence knows, everyone who is here knows, and you must needs have heard how I am punished with sore distraction. What I have done that might your nature, honor, and exception roughly awake, I here proclaim was madness. I was out of control. I didn't know what I was doing. Can that be true of the murder of Polonius? It's possible. He certainly is out of control at that moment. Was it Hamlet wronged Laertes? Never Hamlet. If Hamlet from himself be taken away, and when he's not himself, does wrong Laertes, then Hamlet does it not. Hamlet denies it. His name, his name, his name. He is now in the fullness of the self, fullness of personality. He knows who he is. Who does it then? His madness. If it be so, Hamlet is of the faction that is wronged. His madness is poor Hamlet's enemy. Sir, in this audience, let my disclaiming from a purposed evil free me so far in your most generous thoughts that I have shot mine arrow o'er the house and hurt my brother. I did you wrong. I did not intend it. But notice the image again. It's like shooting the arrow over the house. I stuck my sword through an arras, and I killed someone. It was your father. It was not my intention to do damage at that moment. I was out of control. I was nuts. Do we believe him? It's again, a debatable question. But he is asking pardon. I am satisfied in nature, whose motive in this case should stir me most to my revenge. Okay? All right, I accept. But in my terms of honor, I stand aloof and will no reconcilement till by some elder masters of known honor, I have a voice and precedent and peace to keep my name on guard. All right, I accept your apology, but this still has to be, this has to be judged by older and wiser. Well, who? Claudius? I mean, and we're back at the problem of the court of Denmark. Who's there that's decent? But till that time, I do receive your offered love like love and will not wrong it. I embrace it freely and will this brother's wager frankly play. Okay, let's just play our little game. But it's death. It's doom. There are no games to be played. One cannot judge openly and freely in this rotten court. I'm going to leap ahead to the end. He is cut down unfairly. It is not a fair fight. And the moment he discovers it, okay? And what's the means of discovery? When his mother falls to the ground dying. The drink, I am poisoned. She dies and he shouts, oh villainy, ho, let the door be locked. Important point. So nobody can get out, but also nobody else can come into this chamber of death. And his vision is, we're going to contain it here till it's over. Oh, villainy, ho, let the door be locked. Treachery, seek it out. Something's going on here. Traitorous actions are taking place here. Find out where they are. And Laertes says, it is here, Hamlet. Now, it's beautiful. It's in here, Hamlet. Yes, it is here. It's the king. But we can also say those words mean what? I did it. It's my fault. It is here, Hamlet. He points to himself. Hamlet, thou art slain. No medicine in the world can do thee good. In thee there is not half an hour of life. The treacherous instrument is in thy hand, unbated and envenomed. The foul practice hath turned itself on me. And again, a moment of honesty from Laertes. This was foul practice. I'm getting what I deserved. Lo, here I lie, never to rise again. My mother's poisoned. I can no more. The king's to blame. Now we know the point in venom too, then venom to thy work, and he runs through Claudius. Treason, treason, everyone's shouting. Is it? Huh? Oh, yet defend me, friends, I am but hurt. Hear, thou incestuous, murderous, damned Dane, drink off this potion. Is thy union here? Follow my mother. And the cup is poured down his throat. He gets his own venom, he gets his own poison cup. But Hamlet's the agent. The king dies. And Laertes says he is justly served. Laertes calls it justice. It is a poison tempered by himself. And then, whew, this exchange forgiveness with me, noble Hamlet. And now the compliment from the graveside gets turned back. And Laertes calls Hamlet noble. Mine and my father's death come not upon thee, nor thine on me. Let's wipe it clean. This was a mess. Let's not blame each other. Hamlet, heaven make thee free of it. I'm not in a position to do it. That's for heaven to judge. He's back to sense. Heaven make thee free of it. I follow thee. I am dead, Horatio. Wretched queen, adieu. You that look pale and tremble at this chance that are but mutes or audience to this act, had I but time, as this fell sergeant death is strict in his arrest, oh, I could tell you, but let it be. no energy, no strength to tell Horatio, I am dead, thou livest. Report me and my cause aright to the unsatisfied. And Horatio the Stoic tries to grab the cup. Never believe it. I am more an antique Roman than a Dane. Here's yet some liquor left. As thou art a man, give me the cup. Let go. By heaven, I'll have it. And he knocks the cup. He will not let Horatio commit suicide. Suicide is no longer an option. Hugely important. Things, O God, Horatio, what a wounded name, things standing thus unknown shall live behind me. If thou didst ever hold me in thy heart, absent thee from felicity a while. Five-word line, compound words. And in this harsh world draw thy breath in pain. They're both iambic pentameter. The second line, twice as many words long, takes twice as long to utter it. And in this harsh world draw thy breath in pain. You hear the pain to tell my story. Boom, we hear the march coming. He indeed prophesies the election lights on Fortinbras, who will take over, and ends by saying the rest is silence. Horatio grants nobility again. Notice the word. Now cracks a noble heart. Good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest. Fortinbras comes in. We have a political solution. Fortinbras says, this looks more like a battlefield. And then gives Hamlet soldier's honors. They carry him to the battlements, ironically enough, and shoot the guns as he goes up there. And the last image of him is as a brave soldier. That's within the play. There are questions that remain. We end with a stage littered with corpses. But he has attempted to clean up this mess that wasn't of his making. But the end is a bloody end that draws everyone in except Horatio. There are some questions that remain. But something has regained some balance. Shakespeare can go on and write, there is love, there is nobility, there is forgiveness that survives this mess. But it is a mess. A sick, rotten, corrupt state that turns the young into nihilists or rebels, who then have to turn back on the state and demolish it. And in doing so, destroy themselves. It's a miserable vision. It's an honest vision. It's the modern world. It's the first modern play. It's where we find ourselves. Better solutions will come later from Shakespeare. But right now, he at least, by the end of the play, regains his composure and does not end with the nihilism of the graveyard.